So today is December 29th, 2014, 6th of Tevet, and we're going to do mitzvot 434, and we'll see if we get all the way through to 437.
Oh, wild. Wild is what I said.
What I was just thinking about, because we were just mentioning how we spent our last week, just about the movie, The Theory of Everything, just in Stephen Hawking's quest for one unifying theory. First of all, there is, of course, the incredible pushing through of his physical and still. And it's also interesting to see, as is often the case, that hardship builds you.
Yeah.
And he never would have probably become who he was had that not happened to him, because he was a lazy student.
Yes. Very.
An hour a day.
Yeah, he was a lazy student. Okay, he was smart, but he was lazy. And it wasn't until he realized, oh my gosh, I'm probably going to die in 2 years, so I want to accomplish something before then, that he pushed himself. So he completely shifted his life because of that. And without that, he might not ever have accomplished.
It's incredible that he's still alive. Story.
I know.
Yeah.
He's 70.
But well, they did finally say it's not ALS, it's some other degenerative.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I saw a funny thing.
Not in the movie.
I saw a thing on Postbook that says, "And God said, I nominate the city of Buffalo for the Ice Bucket Challenge."
Yeah.
Anyway, but what I was thinking about, the theory of everything, is that we as Jews understand there is, of course, a theory of everything. We just have to figure out how to express it mathematically. But I was thinking about that because our theory of everything is God, that everything comes from, flows to God, which is why there's the 10 plagues. Right, the whole point of the 10 plagues and leaving Mitzrayim was for God to display his power on all levels so that you could understand that whatever it is, whatever it looks like, God runs the whole show. It's all powered by him. Because, of course, the plagues weren't needed to get us out of Mitzrayim. They're just needed to display power.
Not for God.
Right.
And not so, for Pharaoh.
And so, but that's also why we have gematria, if you think about it. So, you know, he came up with this theory of black holes, and his professor said, "That's great, keep going." He's like, "Keep going, not back in black holes, but now express it mathematically. How do you do that?" So I think that's what gematria is in the end, is how do you express truth mathematically? If it's true, it's true. It's going to be true in math, it's going to be true in language, it's going to be true in the world. How do you express it? And that's what gematria is in its essence. Yes, you can play tons of games with it, but there is a truth in the math. So I think we'll be able to get to a place where that theory of everything is expressible in math, and I hope that he might be somebody who will help with that. But did you see in the Wall Street Journal just 2 or 3 days ago? Also, there was an editorial about science moving towards God.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, because it said, you know, science, which typically has been atheistic.
The anti-God,
really is moving towards a theory of everything, and it just does, and it had all kinds of statistics. It was interesting to see.
Oh, I've got to find that.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Yeah.
Send it to my atheist nephew.
Yeah, it was very...
Or my scientist, he said.
Your scientist, right, because it said that the... Initially, when they were...
Did you send it to Uri?
Not yet. I saved it, though. Oh, it's good Chrissy's not coming today because she would put it in recycling. I have it on the table. I did save it for that because it talks about how when SETI started, and I forget what that stands for, but our search for extraterrestrial life, which has been decommissioned by the government but now is refunded by the private sector. But when they first started it, they really thought, okay, the two parameters necessary for life are this and that. And so there's got to be hundreds of thousands of millions of possibilities. And then they realized there's actually 5. And then they realized there's actually 10. And then they realized there's actually 70. And now they're not even sure how many there are, but there are so many things that are absolutely necessary for life to exist and in such a specific range that if any one of them was off, it wouldn't work. That we came down to from millions of possibilities to thousands of possibilities to hundreds of possibilities to... It really doesn't make sense statistically at all whatsoever that there should be life anywhere, including on this planet. So it's,
and we're proving that
zero,
one day by day.
There's beyond zero possibilities that there should be life statistically.
Anywhere else.
Anywhere.
Here.
Even
let
here.
Alone here.
Even here. Right. That there should. There's no scientific possibility, really, statistically, that life should exist. Because there's so many parameters.
Temperature ranges and
yeah, that there's
all kinds
so many
stuff.
Parameters that are necessary with such a fine tuning that it doesn't make sense that it should exist anywhere. So it says.
You need
this,
the creation. You need
right, so
light.
This article
and you
is
need
saying,
water
right, so this article is saying, really, it's much less of a leap of faith to say there's a God that created it all than to say it just
exist.
Happened. Because it, statistically, it couldn't have just happened. It couldn't have. So So, but science still has to get there on their very own. They don't have that, you know, they want to say it's life is seeded from outer space, whatever they want to say. Okay, whatever. That's up to them. But anyway, it's interesting to see how I think we will get there, and that theory of everything is has to be mathematically framed for some people to handle it. But I think we will all get to that place. We're all seeking that place of one. So I think it's interesting to see that science is seeking that, and hopefully we'll get there soon. Okay, so the mitzvah associated with Torah scholars and adhering to them. So that's not actually the mitzvah in the pasuk.
Okay, so it's not.
No, let's look at the pasuk. Because it's interesting that he starts right away with the interpretation rather than the pasuk itself, which is the manifestation of the mitzvah. So let's look at the pasuk that we have been deriving the last two and this current one and the next mitzvah from. Is from this one pasuk in Deuteronomy chapter 10, pasuk 20. Is that... Okay, you shall fear... Okay, so it's... Es Hashem Elkecha tira oto ta'avod, uvo tidbak, uvishmo tishaveah. Okay, so that's the verse. You shall fear the Lord. So that was one of the six constant mitzvahs we talked about. Fear the Lord your God. Worship Him. That's oto ta'avod. That's tefillah that we talked about, prayer. Cleave to Him. That's our current mitzvah right here. And swear by His name. That's the next mitzvah. So these four are at the list. Okay, so that's why I wrote 1, 2, 3, 4. Those are the three mitzvahs, right? The four mitzvahs in this verse on your page that you can write. It's fearing God, worshiping Him, which equals prayer, cleave to Him, and swear by His name. So right now we're doing the cleave to Him. So you would expect this mitzvah to say, lihidabek bo, cleave to God, right? Because that's the language in the verse. There's two different verses. One says, uvo tidbak, to Him shall you stick, or cleave. Lihidabek bo, and you shall stick to Him. Devek in Hebrew is glue. Niyar devek is tape. Devek means to cleave to.
That's always so interesting.
In English, we have the opposite meanings of cleave, which means separate from and cling to, both.
Right?
And we have that in Hebrew a lot, where the same word means the exact opposites. But in this case...
I never thought of cleave meaning separate.
You meet cleaver.
Oh, okay. All right, okay.
Yeah.
All right, I was thinking of... Yeah. Okay.
Right. It does. Okay. It means separate. Okay. Cleavage is the separation.
Cleavage separation.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And a cleaver cleaves things in half,
right.
And then
cleave to
something means
right.
to stick
to
it. Yeah.
Attached to it.
Yeah,
right.
So that exact word, we have that a lot in Hebrew, but it's rare that we have that in English, where the same exact word means the exact
opposite. Yeah.
Right, but we do have that here. But that's not the case with the word in Hebrew. Devek just means to stick to.
Gotcha.
Doesn't mean to separate from. So, and it means cleave, that kind of sticking, that strong bonding with. So that seems to be the pasuk. But the question is, how do you do it? And he says, how do you do it? Because later on it's written, for the Lord your God is a devouring fire. How could you cleave to God? So he's saying, is there a physical cleaving to God that you can do? You can't, really. I mean, what's the mitzvah then? If a mitzvah is a physical action, how do you do
an
cleaving
inanimate.
To God? Yeah, that's inanimate. Look, that's not inanimate, but not physical in any way. How can you cleave to God? So so that's why I wrote on your papers here, A, B, C, D, E. So the verse, the Sefer Chinuch gives us a few different ways to approach this mitzvah. So the first one is that you should cling to Torah scholars and their disciples, right? So that a Torah scholar does, in a way, represent God. They are the representative of God on the planet. They've learned the Torah. They've integrated it. They understand God's will to the extent that a human being can, depending on who they are, to the extent that they can and to the extent that a human being can. But they get it. And so that the closer you are to them, the more you are really cleaving to God. So that's A, right? That's how the first way. Cling to Torah scholars and their disciples. Through that, it says, though we're bound to Him, blessed is He. For this, our sages of blessed memory inferred further to say, so here's another way, whoever weds the daughter of a Torah scholar. So marrying the daughter of a Torah scholar. Now that's interesting. What does that mean? Right, so I thought, this is a fascinating thing. The daughter of a Torah scholar, what does that mean? She was raised in a Torah home. So she has been thoroughly influenced by the ways of that family. So she's been steeped in Torah. So even if she hasn't spent her time poring over the books, she has seen it in action. She's seen the integration in action. She's been raised in that environment, and therefore she brings that energy into her marriage of this is how you behave. Now, today, the din seems to be, the law seems to be, that any girl who went to Beis Yaakov, through Beis Yaakov,
acquires that.
It acquires that because she's been educated in that way. So that's a new thing. Beis Yaakov is only 100 years old.
And that's a little different than being there from the time that you were
an infant. It is different. So you've acquired it in a different way. One's an intellectual acquiring, which you might think that if you go to Beis Yaakov, you're probably raised in a home that also keeps Torah, most likely. So that you would get it from both ends. But certainly you are getting it through the book end. You know, you're now poring over books. You're now hearing lectures. You now, not just you've observed kashrus in your mother's kitchen so you know how it works very well, but you've actually learned the halachas. I recently had a question, and something that, it's interesting that in this kitchen she would regularly, I called to ask a shayla. We made Chinese food, of course, last week on the 25th,
yeah.
Because that's what Jews do. So that entails a wok, which entails splattering oil, right? So splattering oil with meat in it, and the pot that I made the rice in, which was parv, was moved away from it, because I have trained my family, check, and move the pots away from that rice. But it wasn't moved far enough.
So it got a little
so
bit
now
of splatter
I, So it got quite a bit of splatter on it. The
on
lid
the outside.
On the outside, right. So, but turns out that splatter is very fleishik.
So
it made my parv pot fleishik.
Oh.
Yeah, because it's different than if that amount of oil
had been inside
had dropped inside the pot, it would have been less than 1/60th, and everything would have been still parv. Yeah, everything would have been
interesting.
Still parv.
But the meat sort of
since the oil splattered on the outside and there's nothing to dilute it, it just stuck to the pot with nothing around it.
Okay.
It's straight up pieces of fleishik stuff all over my parv pot, right? So I have to kosher it, right? So, but I wasn't positive. I want to make sure that before I'll do that, because it's kind of a pain, I have to take off the stickers that say parv and like take off the sticky stuff that's underneath the stickers and make sure it's really clean well and boil up the big pot and put it in. Okay, not terrible, but you know, we're talking
that's
20, 30 minutes of hassle, right? So before I'll do that, I just thought I'm going to call and check. So I call and check and I asked the Vada Kashrus. So I called the Vada Kashrus line and they gave me all the numbers. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to call Rabbi Erlinger straight at home. Why shouldn't I just call him? He wasn't there, but his wife was. So I said, what should I do? She said, well, in my experience, because I make schnitzel very, sometimes I don't move my tea kettle far enough away and I have to kosher it. So that's a perfect example. She didn't see it in the book.
She knew
it from her husband that, you know, who's the kashrus expert, that and that's a regular thing that happens in her house. She makes schnitzel often. I don't make schnitzel often. And if I do, I make it in my big soup pot so it doesn't splatter all over the stove. I don't make it in a frying pan. I make it in something deep. But I don't make it often. She does make it often, and she has that problem occasionally that she didn't move the tea kettle, so she knows the halacha. So that's the example is, the point is, that a girl raised in a home where somebody makes schnitzel regularly for Shabbos would know the rule. That, now you have to kosher that.
I just got a tape of my grandfather and his brother from 1971 singing some nigunim. And, you know, the Davidovich brothers. It was very cool. But in it, he references, he said, this tune came from my blessed father-in-law. You know, who I'd never heard him speak about, my grandmother's father.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that he referenced twice.
Nice.
You know, this came from my blessed, holy father-in-law, so-and-so Orgel.
Huh. Very nice.
So it was that sort of wed the daughter. He felt like his father-in-law was some kind of a...
Right, and who was I just listening to? Somebody said that he learned davening from his mother, all the tunes. I think it's Rabbi Yoel Unger. That how to, like, he learned all the tunes of davening
from his mother.
That because he davens from the Amid a lot, but the actual song of it he got from her.
Because why would that?
Because she had that Masorah, she knew them.
So he'd probably just being around her.
Yeah, so whether
sitting in the women's section till he was three.
Whether it was sitting in the women's section or whether she taught him, I don't know. Because there are mothers who teach their sons.
She wouldn't be, you know.
sing to, no, she's not from leading it. No, no. But she probably went to shul enough to know all of that, and she maybe taught him. She maybe sat him down and taught him.
You don't sing in the women's section at all?
Not in ours.
No. Sorry.
Very sadly.
Under your breath.
It is sort of sadly.
It is sad.
Because at the Shabbos table, when there's adult alum, you can. Shalom Aleichem, you can't.
There's, very little singing in our community right now. And I don't think that was always the case. I don't think it was always the case because
we talked about music last week.
There are lots of people who hold that women can sing along in the group and actually sing with a voice. It's not the custom today in Haredi circles. Today in Haredi circles, women either don't do anything or they move their lips or they just whisper it, but they don't sing. But there's definitely people who hold that you can sing as part of the group as long as your voice is blended with the group.
So you're not trying to.
Right. So certainly if there's
loud
singing.
When your girls quit singing.
Yeah.
I remember that.
They did.
Because they always used to sing.
Right, right. So, yeah.
I think it was when, was it when Elisheva first got married?
No.
Or before that?
Then, yeah. No, I mean, she didn't sing in groups, but it was Aviva that still sings, mm-hmm. and she still will sing a lot, but she embarrasses the girls if she does, so, yeah, it's all a thing. Yeah.
And when you have to cast your tea kettle, do you let the water go on the inside, too?
I think you just do Haggala.
It is a pain.
But even if you have one that just has a small spout, it's the only opening. It doesn't have a lid.
Right, you just have to
have
a
go. Let the water go all the way in.
Probably, because you're koshering the whole vessel. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's on the outside.
Yeah.
Move the teapot, I think.
That would be the best.
That's how you learn. Like, you have to kosher it, then you're more careful to really
you
move
never
things
do it again,
far
right.
away. Right, right. Okay, so anyway, marrying the daughter of a Torah scholar is a way of connecting to Hashem deeply because she will bring that hanhaga, that behavior, into your home. I guess this is why we have walls often.
I guess it
it's
is.
Very helpful.
Yeah,
to
that's a little distracting,
yeah.
isn't it? Okay.
Okay. So.
So
right. So she'll bring it into your home. Okay. So then, where there's a second side of that. Let's see. Who weds the daughter of a Torah scholar, or gives his daughter to a Torah scholar
so is that a
in
third
marriage?
One?
That's a number three, right? Okay. So that you then acquire a son-in-law, who's a Torah scholar.
Gotcha.
So let's say your daughter's not. You're not a Talmud Chacham. Your daughter doesn't qualify, and plus she didn't go to Bais Yaakov, so she doesn't have that special din on her, right?
But somebody will take her anyway.
But she's a very nice girl with good midos, and she marries a Torah scholar. Or you are a wealthy person. You looked for a Torah scholar for your daughter. That's what it's saying. Let's
right,
seek this
right,
out.
Right.
Find a Ben Torah. Find a Torah scholar for your son-in-law. And that brings that it into
or has him benefit from as well.
Yeah, and that, right, so that's a separate thing.
Oh, that's right,
yeah.
Okay.
Right, because that brings it into your home. If your son-in-law is a Torah scholar, so then when he comes over, you learn from him. He says his Divrei Torah at the table. But also when he walks, I mean, I just noticed, I went to somebody's house who recently moved into their house. And on their front door was a mezuzah attached with Velcro, reinforced by scotch tape. So, and they're actually a scholar family. But because I recently had my mezuzahs checked by Rabbi Lieberow, so I learned more about mezuzahs, and I learned that they're supposed to be set. They're not supposed to be wobbly at all. Even if it's on there, it won't fall off, which the Velcro and the scotch tape is
made
probably because
it's secure.
It's secure enough it's not going to fall, but it's very wobbly. And you're not supposed to because the bracha is likboa mezuzah, to set it. It has to be set. So it's not supposed to be wobbly at all. So you could do with that with the double stick tape, you know, the thick.
It's not that it has to be nailed. It's just
right,
that it has to not
nails,
be wobbly.
Let's say you have
you
nails.
You can do nails and have it wobble. Sure.
Wobble.
That would not be good
no,
either.
No, you have to get different nails that will hold it on tight. It's supposed to be on tight. So I learned that from him. Right, so that's what your son-in-law, hopefully the Torah scholar, is going to walk into your house and
check
say,
your
oh, just notice that something like your mezuzah is like that, or your tea kettle's too close to your schnitzel, or whatever it is, or your books are stacked inappropriately, right? You have a chumash on the bottom with a sitter on top of that, and your secular book, your magazine's on top of that because you cleared your table. And he'll just remind you that magazines go on the bottom, and then your sitter, and then your chumash, that's the order of books. Secular, holy, holier, right? We have an order of how we stack them. And those kinds of things just make, you know, you bring that into a home and you start to see things differently because there's somebody who helps you see it. Or, and here's the next way, has him benefit from his wealth, right?
So he supports a Torah scholar.
Right, right. So I was in a situation once, this is so fascinating, I was in a very wealthy home in Brooklyn. Very wealthy, I'm sure I told you about it before. A Hungarian, extremely wealthy home with like four layers of silk on their windows. all different drapey things. Their bathroom literally had a chandelier. It was not a joke. Literally, there was a chandelier in the bathroom.
Okay.
And the towels were so gorgeous, I couldn't. I just like air dry.
Don't touch them.
Definitely don't touch anything in there.
I've been in houses like that.
Anyway, yeah. So the men were talking about, and they were talking about their possessions, their stuff, their art. They had just bought a new painting. It wasn't framed yet. They got it for 1.6, and they're just. And I'm thinking 1.6.
And it wasn't
what?
Dollars.
It wasn't dollars, and it wasn't thousands either. So a new painting for 1.6. And I'm like, wow. So they were talking about their stuff, and some of their stuff was the scholars they support. Mm-hmm. They were talking about the fact that they have families. The men were just comparing how many families they
supported
of scholars that they support. That's part of their
possessions.
Makes sense.
It was part of, sharing the... showing off their wealth a little bit. Like, yes, I have that painting, and yes, I have this home, and I have, you know, two or three families that I'm supporting. That's the kind of guy I am. I drive the nice car, I have the nice watch, and I have the Torah scholar families that I support. Right? So it was interesting to see.
So
that's the colo.
Is that...
You would think you wouldn't brag about that.
Yeah. You'd think. Well, but there's different people, you know, so everybody's driven by different stuff. So those people... who are driven by, I want you to see that I have money. Because what's the point of wearing a Rolex? Is only to show that you have money. That's the only reason.
The time it keeps isn't any better than the time.
No, it's worse.
It's not any better than the time.
Yeah, always got worse.
And
but,
it's not
know.
Necessarily
some
prettier.
Some of us wear Timexes.
Right, Timex is very nice.
That's what I've come
especially
to.
Especially the kind you can see in the middle of the night. I
yes.
love that.
And my battery, my thing right. ran out.
Aw.
Yeah, I know.
Replace your battery. I recently got my battery replaced. Now I can see the time in the middle of the night again. Right, so, but let's say you want a prettier one. You could go for a Seiko. Right? That's $100, $150, right?
Still keeps really good time.
Still keeps a really good time, and it's very pretty. Or Movado, right? Also a few
$100. We're going up the scale.
But now you go for a Rolex, you're talking $25,000 or whatever it is, $10,000 for a watch. Like, that's just to say, I have enough money to wear this. That's right. What it's about. It's
doesn't,
not about the looks.
It's not functional.
No, what's pretty about it is the name Rolex in it, and everybody knows. So if you're the type that's motivated
what it really
by that,
means is you have enough money to continue to maintain it.
Right, so, but the point is there are people who want people to see that. Mm-hmm. That's the point of designer clothes, that's the point of designer watches, that's the point of some designer cars.
Like that's, but we do have...
And people do give for that reason, too.
Yes.
But we also,
so if you're the type that's really motivated by that, so let it also be used.
For that, rather
for
than
that.
Another Rolex.
Yeah, right. Let it be used.
I mean, we do have the thing, though, back on sort of what you said, is... that the highest level of charity is he who gives anonymously.
Right. So in this case, would that be considered charity? This is not considered... I mean, it could be considered charity. This is not necessarily considered charity.
This
if
is
you,
making yourself closer to a Torah
yes,
scholar.
That's
I
different
see.
Than
so
tzedakah.
So it could be both. Could
I, don't
be
think,
both.
I don't think this counts out of your tzedakah. Though.
I see. Okay.
I don't think so. I think that just... somebody else.
This yeah. is to bring yourself closer to...
Yeah. It doesn't count on tzedakah.
What she's saying, it wouldn't, the supporting of a Torah scholar wouldn't oh, no. count as tzedakah.
If you're doing
count,
it for this. If you're doing
if
it to fulfill this...
You can't do both at the same.
Maybe you can. Maybe you can. So that's your own Shiloh. But let's say you are saying to yourself, I have money. I want to make sure that I'm fulfilling this mitzvah in the best way I can with my means. I'm going to go find a family that I can support to make sure that that husband stays in learning because I want to connect to Hashem through connecting to a person and give that person the benefit of my money.
But it does seem...
That's different than tzedakah.
Yeah.
You know, tzedakah is saying that person is struggling and they need help and
okay,
I am a person
right,
of means
that.
And therefore I will share my means with them so that their family shouldn't go hungry or that
right.
they should be able to fix their roof or they should
whatever,
be able to have
right.
clothes. That's different
yeah.
than saying I want to ensure
my closeness. But it does seem strange.
You could probably
to accomplish, to achieve closeness through a monetary... method.
Well, I'm
I mean, the
guessing,
marrying,
right.
the giving the daughter, the...
Right, so
you know,
then the question is, so what does that mean, right?
You know, that just, I don't know.
Right, so it benefits from his wealth. Maybe that means that they're proactively doing it. They're looking for the person, they're seeking the person, they're creating the relationship with the person, they're giving the person the money in order that they should... So maybe it's not an embarrassment. Like, giving somebody tzedakah... Like,
wait, right.
You know, that's an embarrassment. Look, somebody's look, hard on their luck or whatever it is. Somebody was able to support themselves and then can't. And then you have to give them money for groceries. They're embarrassed over that. That's different than maybe somebody who's learning and wants to learn full time is not embarrassed. And you could say to them, I want you to learn. I commit to $40,000 a year, $50,000, $60,000 a year so that you can stay in learning. And then you bring in the check. It's not a busha. It's not embarrassing. Yeah. You're purchasing their learning for them, for you. And then they shouldn't feel embarrassed. Mm-hmm.
I knew that was going to happen. I saw that. I saw that. We all saw that.
No problem. Anyway, so I think that it might be. I think if the point is to connect to the Shekhinah,
it has to be some intent.
It shouldn't be that you're just sending a check.
It should be some intent.
It should be some context.
It's not the
context.
It's not the raffle ticket I buy for the yeshiva or the ticket to the yeshiva dinner.
I mean, I think that could do
it.
Is not.
What doesn't fulfill this probably? I think it probably does in the tiniest, least little bit. Because what you're saying is, I appreciate the fact that there is Torah learning. Like, I don't remember if I said in this context
right.
or not.
It's better than giving $100 to Kent School.
Right. So I, for instance, I was just thinking about with the Levies moving, you know, the difference between Portland and Denver. And how hard it is for them in Portland.
Is it?
We have a kol up here. We have yeshiva here. We have Bais Yaakov here. So even if maybe those schools are running in ways that aren't in total consonance with a person's life, thoughts, feelings, whatever it is, they certainly create an environment here in Denver, Colorado, that makes our city what's called a Makom Torah. We're a Makom Torah. Portland, Oregon.
Place of Torah, yeah.
Portland, Oregon is not. They don't have a high school for either gender. Not even a Ramah kind of a high school, you know, but they don't. They have through eighth grade.
They have a small Jewish community, you know?
Yes, they do. But one of the reasons why they do, because I don't know exactly what Portland was like 80 years ago, 60 years ago, but a big difference between the two cities is that this one established a strong day school and high schools and post-high school learning. So, and that has anchored this community in this town. So that even Jews who are very far, there is real Torah in this city. You know, as opposed to Portland, Oregon. I'm just thinking the difference.
Oh,
so,
Portland,
so
Oregon didn't have very many Jews in it ever.
And that, they had more than they do now.
That's probably true. Hmm. 80, I lived there. I went to college there.
Uh-huh, yeah, so. But so I'm saying like 80 years ago, they had more than they do now. But they never established the anchors that keep a Torah... keep Torah in the community, whereas Denver did. So, for that reason, even buying the $100 raffle ticket for yeshiva...
Right, is somewhat of a...
does connect you, because you're keeping that institution functioning, which keeps more of an environment here. And that brings us to the... well, that doesn't bring us to that. It does bring us to our last way of connecting, which I'll tell you. But first, we're going to get to this one. Learning, so the Medrash Sifrei says that another way to connect to Hashem is to learn, and now this is interesting, not just to learn Torah, to specifically learn the words of the homiletic ethical teachings, right, the Agadata. So, and I think you ladies are learning some Agadata, right, when you're learning the Ein Yaakov, that's Agadata. But when you learn Agadata, you learn the mind of Hashem.
Marlon's doing that.
Oh, Marlon's doing that. Right. You guys are doing it together. Okay.
No.
So you learn the mind of Hashem a little bit. You get some insights into the mind of the author when you read an author regularly. But uh-huh. this is where you get more of the insights into the mind of the author than you do with just, let's say, genealogies or the story they left from here, they went to there, or this was born, you know, that kind of thing. That Agadata is where you get insight into the mind of the author. So that's also a way to connect to Hashem. So now let's talk about this, okay? So it's interesting. I heard a nice lecture, an interesting lecture from Rabbi Shlomo Freifeld. So Rabbi Shlomo Freifeld died a long time ago. These are lectures recorded in the 70s. So he said, how do you keep a mitzvah? We don't have any Talmid Chachamim today. It's interesting. In the 70s, he's saying that. When there were bigger scholars, when Moshe Feinstein is still alive, right? He said, but how much more so today in 2014, almost 15? Like, what do we have? Like, who do we have that you can really connect to? You know, so we have these other ways, but like, we don't, to really connect to a Torah scholar, what do we have? So he says, we don't have them, but what we do have is a community. And in a community, a scholar is embodied in the collective. Mm-hmm. So that if you look at a community of Torah-keeping Jews, one is really careful in Shmiras HaLashon. right, in guarding his tongue. And another one's really careful in Kavana and Brachos. And another one's really careful in how they dress. And another one's really careful to pay on time. Whatever work they hire, they always pay on time. They make sure they have the money. Right? And another person's really careful to...
So collectively you have
to always greet people with a smile, right? So that if you're connected to the community, you will then be in the presence of, collectively, a scholar, and you will then be influenced to behave that way, to know Hashem better, to connect to Hashem better. So I would say that is also the value of that $100 raffle ticket for the yeshiva. Mm-hmm. That is. Because that keeps our community Torah-oriented, and that keeps those who keep the Torah in our community, right? Because we have a yeshiva, because we have a Beis Yaakov, we have a Hillel Academy for all their children, and we have all the teachers that are needed for all those institutions. We keep seeds throughout our community of people who are deeply connected to Torah, and that makes a difference for all of us, right? It really does.
So we may not have one person.
However much we want to keep or don't keep, but the point is that there are people there that are deep in their commitments, and that makes a difference. That radiates out, and we all live in that environment where we can see that, and that makes a difference for us, and we're able to connect to Hashem on a deeper level with those types of people as our neighbors. So that's an important thing to help support neighbors like that. Okay, this precept is in place everywhere, every time, for men and even for women, right? So it's interesting because it's a little bit different for men than it is for women.
Yeah.
But for women also, they do need to hear the words of Torah scholars that they will learn to know the Lord. So that's interesting because remember we talked about in the past, the obligation of Torah learning for men and for women is different, right? Men have to learn because they connect through that.
Right.
Women have to learn so they can know what to do and desire to do it.
Right.
So this is that aspect. They need to know what to do, but they need to know Hashem. Excuse me. So knowing Hashem or learning Hashem and having and that's part of the desire to do it. That's part of the woman's obligation. She has to be there enough to learn enough to connect to Hashem, to hear enough that she feels connected. Okay. That's that. Why does this always happen? That the clock goes so much faster. Okay, 4:35. This is an interesting mitzvah. It's actually a positive commandment to take an oath in God's name.
I was
going to
say, it is.
Right?
Yes.
Right? And so how often do we hear this? Because we're so careful to say Bli Neder all the time. Right?
No oath.
Right? So here's the mitzvah, to swear by his name at a time that we need to reinforce and confirm something or to thrust it far away. For thus, the greatness, power, and exalted nobility of his law are manifested. About this it is stated, and by his name shall you swear. Okay, so it says, swear by his name. Now, just as an unnecessary oath is prohibited, a necessary oath is commanded. Now, there's lots of controversy about this. Should you, shouldn't you? Is this the first time you're hearing this?
Yeah,
yes,
first
it is,
time
right?
It is the first
this.
Time.
Yes, it is, because this is not how we behave.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Because this is the mitzvah, but we basically don't do this.
Because we don't know what's the necessary.
We're very careful with this. Right, so now let's look back up, and that's why I quoted the verse in Mitzvah 4:34. Let's look back at that verse. So the verse is, you shall fear the Lord, you shall worship him, you shall cleave to him, and swear by his name. Okay, so it's four positive commandments there.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's see the Rashi, that's under 4:35 on that verse. You shall fear the Lord your God, and worship him, and cleave to him. After you have all these qualities, then you may swear by his name. So, okay, so there's a machloket. Is this a standalone mitzvah? Or is this a mitzvah with condition? Right? Is it conditional? Are there prerequisites? Do you first have to have accomplished that you fear God, that you worship him, that you cleave to him, and now you're on the level that you could swear in his name? Is that it?
And is it that you believe you've done those, or that the community?
Right. So, but the question is, that's even going further, right? How do we measure that? But the question
first of all, is it absolute?
Let's just start.
Or conditional?
Is it conditional or is it absolute? Right. So that is a question. So, and the Rambam even seems to come down sort of on both sides of that. It's not clear. So it seems that only in a court of, that when needed, you're supposed to do this. So the question then is, what's when needed? Should you do it just to strengthen yourself? Let's say you're pre-diabetic, right? And you love desserts, and you're having such a hard time, even though you know it's bad for you. You're having such a, but you're a firm person. So you know, if you'll say, right, which I'm not saying, but if you will say, I take a vow in the name of God that I will not eat dessert ever again, right? Or I will not overload myself on carbs.
Then having made that,
you know you won't touch it. You won't. Because you will, because it tastes good, but you won't if you know that's a mitzvah. That you're the type. You never would eat treif food, ever. So why would you ever eat something that you make treif by saying that? You wouldn't. So if you're the type that, so there might be a positive commandment in that case like that to do it. But even in that case, we're very careful today not to do that. So when is it needed? So is it needed because of that?
The Torah said, swear by his name, and the Torah also said, do not swear.
Right. So it seems that the only time that it's needed is in a Beis Din. There are times when you have to take a vow in a Beis Din. Like, let's say you borrowed money, and you paid it back.
And you have to.
And the person doesn't ever remember getting that money back. And they're saying, in the Beis Din, no, you didn't pay me back. And you're saying, yeah, I did.
That would be
so
a time.
That is a time that you would swear in God's name and fulfill this commandment.
And then by doing that,
that will change then the Beis Din will rule in your favor. Right. So, but yeah, that is a time that you would, that's when it's needed, is to take an oath in God's name. But in general, we're very careful not to. So even when we go to court today, we don't take an oath in God's name in general. Like when we swear on the Bible, we don't swear, we affirm. Right? That's what we do. So we try very hard not to do this. That's why you haven't really seen, that's why it's surprising that this is one of the 613, to swear in God's name. It's just that we don't actually do it. We're very careful not to say God's name when we don't need to. And the question is, what do we need to? Ancillary to this is making a bracha that we didn't need to make.
Which we talked about that. Mm-hmm.
So we didn't need to make them. What do we do in the case that we did? Right? You have an apple in your hand, you make the bracha, or whatever it is, a piece of candy, chocolate in your hand, and you make the bracha, and it falls out, it melts between your fingers, it's a hot day. Okay, I guess if it was a chocolate, you could still lick your fingers, right? If you can't recover it.
You
dropped it, right? You dropped it in the sand, you're not picking it up to eat it. It's now gross, you're not, right? So, what do you do? There's not another apple, there's not another borei pri'etz, you already said the whole borei pri'etz, and now it's on your hand. What do you do? You just said a bracha that, right? You said God's name. So the answer is you say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Ve'ed. Now the question is why? Why do you say that? What are you doing when you say that? That is the answer. And I put down here two things: bracha levatala and bracha she'ena tzricha. There's two different kinds of brachas. One is a bracha that you shouldn't have made, and one is a bracha that you didn't need to make. So a bracha levatala is when you lost the apple, right? Or when you just said it for fun. Kids do this sometimes in school. Practicing is not considered levatala.
Oh.
But sometimes in school, I have seen kids do this. It's wrong and they shouldn't. But because you're not supposed to say bracha levatala, let's say you asked a friend for a bite of their candy and they said no. You could stand in front of them and say, Shakol Nieh Bidvaro. And then they don't want that you transgress. So they have to give you a bite of their candy because you already made a bracha on it. Right? I've seen kids do that to each other, okay? So that's a bracha levatala, really. It could be if the kid says, no, it's my licorice and I'm not sharing. Right? Now you said a bracha levatala, you have to say bracha shem kavod. What about a bracha she'ena tzricha? Right? You just had a piece of licorice, right? Let's skip licorice because that might be mezonos. You just had a sucking candy. That was a shakol nieh bidvaro. And now you want to drink. And you just weren't paying attention. Like you're just thirsty from it. Right? And so now you pick up a glass of water. You say shakol again. That's the same bracha. You just said it a minute ago. That was a bracha you didn't need to say because you just said it. Right? Even if you weren't thinking of the water that second, but you just said it. It's in the same session. Like you're just, you just said it. So that's a bracha she'ena tzricha. Both of them. The remedy is to say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Ve'ed afterwards. Now the question is why? Is it a tikkun? Do you repair the damage that you did by saying God's name in vain? Or is it tshuva?
Right.
Right? Which is it that you're doing it? And it's interesting just to think about, and do we need to think about it? It's a question because any which way, that's what you do. But I'll give you an interesting case that I learned from Rabbi Rosner that I didn't know about because I don't put on film. However, our Ashkenazi men make two brachas when they put on tefillin, because that's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. But our Sephardi men make one. So the Rambam says you should make one. And Ashkenazim make two. So after they put on the tefillin shel Rosh, they say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Ve'ed. Why?
Just in case.
Why? Is it just in case?
Or is it to repair?
Or is it because they just received the Ol Malchut Shemaim upon themselves? They just engaged in the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, and now they are saying, "Blessed is the glorious name of God forever and ever," right? Which we say after we say
so
the Shema.
So does it have anything to do with saying the second?
So we, in that case, which is a daily basis, they actually are meant to delay saying it. They're supposed to delay saying it for a little while, because after bracha, you're supposed to say it right away, as quickly as you can, right away, just to fix up whatever it was, whether you're fixing it or whether you're doing tshuva, but you're supposed to do that right away. Here they specifically delay. Yeah, they wait a little bit in between. So it shouldn't look like you knew for sure you were saying a bracha levatala, and now you're just repairing it. It should be that I have the shita. I say my two brachas, and I receive the Omachot Shemayim. But just like as a tip of my hat to the Rambam, this is you should only say one.
So it is a bit of covering
right.
your bases.
Right, so yeah. It's kind of a covering your bases, but with understanding that you are accepting the Omachot Shemayim, and that, yeah. So it's an interesting thing. Some of our men who make the two brachas. Right. Anyway, so in general, our rule is that we don't take an oath in God's name. We're not supposed to do that. That's the general rule, unless we need to. So that's generally based in. So that's that. So I think we should probably wait.
For yeah, I would say
to start okay. Even though we have. Oh, yeah, I guess we are 2 minutes after. So okay, so we are going to wait.
For
next week,
okay.
Yeah, to go into the next
and
one.
And we have class next week.
And next week, we do have class, yes. Okay. The following week, we do not, yes. Okay. Great. Okay, so have a terrific
week
to everybody.